Today, I'm in Calabasas, California, a city in the San Fernando Valley region of Los Angeles County, and I have some time to kill as my car is charging up, so I thought I would go for a stroll in what is known as the Commons, which is an entertainment complex where celebrities and anthropologists can sometimes be spotted shopping, but the real attraction for me today is in the far end, in front of the restaurants, where they have a great water feature with a pirate's cove, waterfalls, and lots of large, colorful koi fish and dozens of aquatic turtles, which is why it's known to locals as Turtle Pond. There are four sculptures representing the four seasons and dynamic statues that spit out water. But the real attraction, for me at least, is seeing so many turtles in an open-air layout, laying out in the warm California sun and watching them swim, which never seems to get old. Of course, as an anthropologist, turtles often remind me of the Galapagos Islands, which are famous for their large tortoises, and where Charles Darwin laid the foundation for his theories concerning biological evolution. Darwin stated that all species of organisms arise and develop through the natural selection of small, inherited variations that increase the individual's ability to compete, survive, and reproduce. These genetic variations were traditionally thought to come about via random mutation, which are a fundamental part of the mechanism described in natural selection. But are genetic mutations across the genome really random? Recent studies published in the journal Nature concerning certain types of small flowering weeds have led scientists to a new understanding about DNA mutations, radically changing our understanding of evolution or how a species may change heritable characteristics over successive generations. Mutations occur when DNA is damaged and left unrepaired, creating a new variation. The scientists wanted to know if mutation was purely random or something deeper. What they found was unexpected. According to Gray Monroe, an assistant professor in the UC Davis Department of Plant Sciences, who is the lead author on the paper, quote, "We always thought of mutation as basically random across the genome. It turns out that mutation is very non-random, and it's non-random in a way that benefits the plant. It's a totally new way of thinking about mutation." Instead of randomness, they found patches of the genome with low mutation rates. In other words, the plant is able to protect its genes from mutation to ensure survival, which upends the central assumption of Darwin's theory that these variations arise randomly, and that only natural selection determines which genes change more quickly and which more slowly in the course of evolution. Darwin's most effective argument, in my opinion, had to do with his study of the bird known as the finch. Darwin observed that beak shape varies amongst finch species, and on the Galapagos, finches on the various islands seem to evolve based on different food sources. Long, pointed beaks served well for snatching insects, while broad, blunt beaks worked best for cracking seeds and nuts. He postulated that the beak of an ancestral species had adapted over time to equip the finches to acquire different food sources. So, for example, the woodpecker finch's beak is perfectly adapted for stripping away bark. But if the insect it is after is deep in the branch, it needs a tool. So the finch uses a cactus spine to poke into the hole and extract bits of the insect by stabbing it with the spine before eating it. On the other hand, the large ground finch has a short, broad beak for cracking nuts to feed on hard seeds. The large, thick size of its beak is necessary for its method of survival, or making a living. Its food source is different, and so its beak shape is different. So by looking at examples of these two finches, a trained eye can make a lot of assumptions about their behavior and lifestyle by the shape of their beaks, even if one did not directly observe the birds during their lifetime. This same reasoning holds true with the various hominin species that genomic sequencing has revealed are contained in our DNA, with various degrees of admixture distributed among the various racial groups on Earth. In the case of the hominin skull, a properly trained anthropologist, which in the modern era are few and far between, should be able to determine the specimen's diet based on a degree of prognathism, which means how far the mouth sticks out from the face. Homo erectus, or Homo habilis, for example, were strictly hunter-gatherers for over 2 million years, up until the end of the Pleistocene, or Ice Age. Hunter-gatherers tend to live in groups of about 40 individuals, as they do not survive as well in numbers greater or less than 40. There were never any civilizations of hunter-gatherers that developed metal tools, built megalithic structures, established armies, or achieved anything associated with modern humans. They are considered super archaic, a term that denotes that they were considered very primitive as opposed to Cro-Magnon, for example, which is fully modern. Cro-Magnon is the only hominin that had a prominent chin. It first shows up in the fossil record around 40,000 years ago, with no prognathism, implying that it used its back molars to chew, a trait attributed to having a mostly agricultural diet. Cro-Magnon were also the first to use bifacial stone tool technology in spears and bow and arrows. There's evidence that they lived in wooden houses, they were seafaring, kept track of celestial patterns, and the first to domesticate animals used in large-scale agriculture, such as horses and oxen. These domesticated animals are a requisite for Stone Age agricultural civilization, and while the cataclysms that ended the Pleistocene have left anthropologists very little direct evidence of Ice Age farming, like the finch beaks, the skull structure of Cro-Magnon, including its chin, lack of prognathism, and massive cranial capacity, which is larger than today's hybridized average, speaks to its almost certain agricultural lifestyle and high cognitive ability. Recent DNA samples taken from Charles Darwin's grandson has shown that Darwin himself belonged to haplogroup R1b. That said, some articles go on to say that Darwin was a direct descendant of Cro-Magnon people, who first entered into Europe roughly 30,000 years ago. Genealogist Spencer Wells says, quote, "Men belonging to haplogroup R1b are direct descendants of Cro-Magnon people who, beginning 30,000 years ago, dominated the human expansion into Europe and heralded the demise of the Neanderthals species." The problem for the out-of-Africa replacement model is that DNA sequencing of a 28,000-year-old Cro-Magnon type specimen has revealed that it was almost genetically identical to modern European populations. If Cro-Magnon is identical to modern European populations, then when did this alleged evolution and mutation from sub-Saharan Africans allegedly take place? The fact that Cro-Magnon and its direct descendants in Europe and Asia do not contain genetic admixture from super-archaic hominins such as Homo erectus or Homo habilis, which has recently been discovered in the DNA of modern sub-Saharan populations in West Africa, that is not found in the DNA of modern Asians or Caucasians poses a big problem for the out-of-Africa replacement hypothesis, which proposes that sub-Saharan Africans mutated into Asians and Europeans roughly 35,000 years ago when Cro-Magnon, or early modern humans, suddenly shows up in the fossil record. With the advent of genomic sequencing, the out-of-Africa model falls apart, and this supposed linear progression of hominin species that mainstream anthropologists insist took place is looking more and more like a fairy tale. Instead, humanity is comprised of hominins that did not share the same ancestry or history, and much like the diversity that we find in Darwin's finches, our ancestors had very different lifestyles, different methods of obtaining food, which resulted in some demographics living as hunter-gatherer lifestyles and others domesticating animals, establishing agricultural civilization, building megalithic stone structures such as pyramids, developing metals like copper, bronze, and iron, and colonizing the world while interbreeding with various archaic populations of hominins, resulting in a diversity in humanity that we see today. In my last episode, which I'll leave a link to in the description, I talked about some of the various problems that still exist in the fossil record, linking mankind with alleged tree-dwelling ancestors, particularly in the context of a yet unidentified transitional species into bipedalism, commonly referred to as a missing link. Another evolutionary dilemma is presented in blood types, where there's a compatibility issue because of the presence or absence of certain antigens, which can trigger an immune response if they're foreign to the body. If mankind evolved from the same ancestor, then everyone's blood would be compatible, but it's not. Rhesus negative blood types appear suddenly with Cro-Magnon. Why does the body of an Rh negative mother carrying an Rh positive child try to reject her own offspring? It's clear that humanity is a hybrid species, and that it's interesting to note that of the 612 primate species and subspecies recognized by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, not one of them is Rh negative blood type. In The Origin of Species, Charles Darwin says little about human evolution, other than to assert firmly that we humans did evolve and are part of the interrelated natural world along with all other organisms. That said, a direct transitional link between mankind and arboreal or tree-dwelling ancestors has not yet been established in the fossil record, which is why articles are still published using terms such as missing link, with many new dilemmas arising with the advances made in the field of genetics. Perhaps the apparent gap in humanity's origins has already been solved by the ancient mythologies of the world, which secret societies, occult organizations, and some governments of the 20th century took seriously, while modern academia continues its search for the ever-elusive missing link. Just some food for thought. All this talk of food has made me hungry, and I decided to stop by at one of my favorite restaurants in Calabasas called the King's Fish House. Their most popular dish is their Alaskan halibut, which is said to be the world's largest flat fish, allegedly weighing up to 500 pounds and can grow up to 8 feet long. It comes either pan-seared or grilled and is served with two sides. In my case, I chose steamed spinach and cauliflower, and I was very happy with my choice. Thank you. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon and through all other major book outlets. If you'd like to support my work, you can do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description. Please subscribe for future updates. Leave your thoughts below. Have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.